What is your equivalent of getting the reps in to improve your taste? The intuition that doing something less ambitious will be easier in some probabilistic sense, you know, more likely to succeed. Actually, I think that is 180 degrees wrong. There should be at least as many talent investors as there are venture investors. The role of the founder is to sort of advance both like a vision and a resource unlock and use the resource unlock to shape the vision and vice versa. Anyone who thinks this has played out, you know, like we already know who the winners are, and that's ludicrous. Your ability to identify and support and nudge those individuals in a positive direction could be a really important lever for building the world you want to see.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. My guest today is Matt Clifford. Matt is a co-founder of Entrepreneur First and leads their AI efforts, as well as a chair of ARIA, the UK's advanced research and invention agency. We talk about EF, talent investing, ambition, why we don't have more Thiel fellowships, his new focus on AI and AI safety concerns. Please enjoy. You're about 13 or 14 years 13. Into EF. I think that's incredible. In looking back, what specific hypotheses do you feel like you validated or invalidated about EF?
I think, you know, the big one, and I worry in a way that we sometimes overlook it because it now seems so obvious, is just that you really can build venture scale companies by backing individuals who don't have a team and an idea. You know, I mean, that was the thing that when we were running around, I mean, we left our jobs to start Entrepreneur First in the summer of 2011, but really it took us sort of 3 years to figure out the model we have today. And, you know, a big part of that, other than our own like incompetence and like, speed of learning, a big part of the reason it took 3 years to land on what we do today is just that people just thought it was such a stupid idea. You know, like the amount of adverse selection that must be baked in if you back people before they, you know, like people that want to be founders but don't have a team and an idea, like it just breaks all the rules of how you're meant to think about this problem space. And, you know, my view on that is that the people that told us that were not stupid. In fact, they were some of the smartest people in venture. But, you know, what if you put it sort of in machine learning terms, everyone's like model of what works in venture is trained on a very censored data set, you know, like because no one really in the history of venture has tried with any like at any scale and for any length of time to do something like what we call talent investing, backing people before their teams and ideas. Of course, all the pattern recognition on everything that's worked is people that didn't do that, people that already knew their co-founder and already had their idea. And so, you know, I think the biggest thing I think we validated is that actually it's true that talent is what matters most. And, you know, yeah, you need the right product. And at the start, again, like part of the reason it took a few years to figure out was we had the wrong product. But if you get the right people, then yeah, like that is enough to get to the point where, I don't know what it is today, $11 billion worth of companies, a couple of unicorns, et cetera. You know, it's that's probably the biggest surprise to all of us.
You said that your hypothesis was really around talent, like starting with talent first and being able to build up from there. I've heard repeatedly from founders and VCs alike that there is the limiting constraint on incredible new companies is talented founders. Do you feel like that is actually the case? Is it a sourcing problem, or is it actually a lack of talented, ambitious founders that's the bottleneck to kind of, I'll call it broadly, progress in terms of startups?
Well, I mean, I think if you had to point to one thing, if you had to say it in a sentence, it would be founders. But I think it's sort of, it's founders immersed in the right sort of culture and the right sort of network. And, you know, that's what I hope that Entrepreneur First provides. So, you know, I think one of the, I guess, another hypothesis that I feel we've validated is that founders aren't that different. You know, like one of my like more controversial like theories of how venture has worked historically is that there's a lot of people in the broad entrepreneurial space who spent a lot of time telling me a decade ago that like founders are different. There's like, you know, like they're just different. They're built different. There's a founder gene almost, like you've either got it or you haven't. And to me, particularly now, but, you know, I think there's a lot of evidence outside Entrepreneur First this is true. This is definitely wrong. You know, the thing, and you sort of see this, like you ask venture capitalists, like, what do you look for in great founders? And they say stuff that if you were to ask like great executive recruiters what they look for in great executives, they would say the same things. Like, it's actually pretty hard for people to point out things that are that weird about founders. But I think part of the reason that it's a popular thing to say is that in many ways, being a founder is such a such a horrible experience relative to, you know, like relative to what anyone with the level of skill needed to be a successful founder could be doing in terms of like, you know, coziness.
Right.
But there's like almost a need to believe that it's like predetermined in some way. It's almost like a guild like mentality to limit supply. In saying that, and so like, sorry, this is a long answer to your question, but you know,
no,
you said,
this is
like,
great.
What is the bottleneck? I think the bottleneck is sort of it's not talent per se. Like, the talent's out there. It's talent that is sufficiently connected into a culture that says entrepreneurship is not only fine, it's not only good, but it's actually the best thing you can do. It's the most valuable thing you can do. Like, there's many, you know, like, in a way, I feel like the success of Silicon Valley is overdetermined, but one of the reasons that it is still successful, so successful today, and that it resisted all the sort of like potential unraveling of its network effects during the pandemic is that it remains the one place in the world where you don't have to justify why you're starting a company to people. It's the obvious thing to do. It's not just an okay thing to do, it's the obvious thing to do. It's very suspicious to want to go work at Goldman Sachs in Silicon Valley. That's not the case in London. It's not the case in Singapore, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think the scarcity is like talent meets culture. And you know, in a nutshell, one of the things that we've tried to do with Entrepreneur First is sort of create bubbles of that culture in places that otherwise don't have it.
And so if I'm reading you correctly, self-belief or kind of this reality distortion field is the limiting constraint, but you believe to some degree you can cultivate that through culture?
I don't know if it's self-belief even. I mean, I think like clearly it's like correlated, but it's more the sense that the this is a path that is legible to you and that is like valorized in some way. You know, it's funny, I think that's another thing that a lot of insiders, for want of a better word, sometimes have pushed back on. The idea that entrepreneurs need validation that what they're doing is right. I think a lot of people find that idea, a lot of insiders, you know, a lot of people who've been in this industry for a while, you know, they hate you. And I understand it, having now been in this field long enough that you see, you know, like the tourists in, you know, inverted commas, right, that come in the boom. Like, no one likes the tourists, right? But I think, again, it's like a guild-like mentality that we've got to shut out the outsiders. And, you know, there's got to be something special about entrepreneurs. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, I would love to believe that I was really special. But I honestly think it's mainly about like macro talent allocation, which is primarily a cultural phenomenon. If you are in the Bay Area, you know, you can believe that like, hey, we're outsiders. But if you're an entrepreneur in the Bay Area, you're the ultimate insider. You're doing the right thing you're meant to do. You're not doing anything countercultural. And to be clear, I think that's a great thing. I think we need more pockets of the world where it's not countercultural. We shouldn't insist on this being some weird value to it being a weird and contrarian thing to do. We should insist on the opposite. This is the greatest, in the age of the internet, probably particularly in the age of AI, this is like the greatest opportunity for like impact at scale in the history of our species. Like, we should celebrate that, not be like, well, entrepreneurs are actually really weird and different. And like, you know, like, we should be telling more people, don't waste your life trying to make your boss look good. You know, like, build something that can scale to, you know, to the entire world.
That does seem to be an unpopular message in some circles today. You touched on one or maybe a couple qualities that are really critical for founders and maybe applied to leaders in a broader sense as well. What are the other qualities after a decade plus and viewing thousands of prospective or wannabe founders as well as accomplished founders? What are the one, two, three critical qualities that are an indicator of future success?
I mean, I always think my answer to this is really boring, for the reasons that I sort of described, which is that I do think that effectiveness in a founder is a really good predictor of success. But effectiveness is sort of what we look for in nearly every elite field of human activity. And so, you know, I kind of feel it's always a cop-out when I say we like founders who are really determined, who are really smart, who, and it's like, oh, well, no kidding. But it is true. You know, I think like what, if I were to say like at the margin, like what is like more important in a founder than in, you know, like an executive of an established company, I think this idea that others have talked about of sort of, you know, I think it's probably a Paul Graham idea originally, this like relentless resourcefulness, you know, that is, I think, a really powerful framing of something very true, which is, I think probably the single biggest between being a founder and being an executive of an established company, of a big company, is this idea that as a founder, whatever your like, you know, like long-term goal, whatever your North Star is, your short-term goal is almost always just trying to unlock more resource to get towards that goal. Now, okay, you could frame being an executive in a big company as being about that, but actually, usually the scale of the unlock relative to what you have today is not going to be that large. Whereas a founder, at least at the beginning, you're creating something out of nothing. So the initial unlock is like infinite as expressed as a fraction, right? And so, you know, I do think that, you know, and I'm not sure there are that many helpful ideas from like the academic study of entrepreneurship that are that, I think they're fascinating, but I'm not sure that they're helpful for founders. But one that I do like is this idea of like effectual thinking, the idea that founders are, that the role of the founder is to sort of in parallel advance both like a vision and a resource unlock and use the resource unlock to shape the vision and vice versa. And that I think is something that is an activity that one is critical for founders. It's pretty different from most other fields. And that some people just do seem to have a knack for. That said, I think it's teachable. I think it's a mindset. I think it's about, probably the piece of advice I give most commonly to founders outside the US, where, you know, like there's a lot more cultural sort of suspicion of ambition, is that there's a very common thing that happens everywhere else in the world where you talk to people and they're clearly very ambitious. And then you ask them about their ideas, and they seem weirdly less ambitious than the founder seemed in the abstract. And you say like, oh, you know, shouldn't you gently, you know, like, couldn't you think bigger? Could you add a few zeros to the end of these, you know, numbers? And you fairly rapidly arrive usually at this crux, which is that they think that they need to increase their odds of success by lowering their ambition. And you know, there's lots to unpack there, which I won't unpack about like, you know, why they think they need to increase their odds of success and all these things. But the interesting thing, the bit I want to talk about with reference to your question, is the intuition that doing something less ambitious will be easier in some probabilistic sense, you know, more likely to succeed. Actually, I think that intuition is 180 degrees wrong. Like, if you think about what is your job as a founder, really is to unlock resources in pursuit of a vision. Well, guess what? Like, all the resources you want to unlock are attracted to ambition. Like, you want to raise capital from investors, they only make money if you do something really big. They're attracted to ambition. You want to hire people whose opportunity cost includes potentially becoming a founder? Guess what? You better be doing something really, really big. Otherwise, there's just no way that's going to pay off for them. And so I think like one thing Silicon Valley is good at is like, not necessarily in an explicit sense, but implicitly just internalizing that idea that actually ambition makes things easier, not harder. And so, you know, like coming back to the question, you know, like I do think that your ability to sort of internalize that a compelling way to tell your story is the ultimate unlock, and being able to tell that story is something that is probably, yes, teachable, but when you see it in a founder, it's very, you know, like that's when you get excited.
I think you alluded to this a few moments ago, but do you believe that ambition is teachable? And I would maybe distinguish between kind of holistically teachable, like going from zero to one versus maybe on the margin, which is what you're describing here, is you have a vision for a company that could maybe be $100 million versus think about something that could be $10 billion. Is kind of wholesale ambition something that's teachable? And if so, how?
I'm not sure that you can teach someone who's unambitious to be ambitious, but you can teach someone who is ambitious that they may be, if they change the context of how they calibrate ambition, the number, whatever, you know, like the measure, and, you know, it doesn't have to be dollars, but the measure of impact, you know, could be like several orders of magnitude bigger. Honestly, I think one of the great things that Sam Altman has done for the world in the last few years is just teach people that you can always think bigger. You know, I think this recent thing with the headline number of $7 trillion raise, you know, it's just such a great object lesson in teaching ambition. Now, again, like, I'm not saying that everyone should go out and raise $7 trillion, obviously, but I think it helps show that you know, however, whatever it means for you to be like very ambitious, somewhat ambitious, like if you're very ambitious, you need to understand what that could mean. Like, you know, like we're now playing in a world where that could mean going out to raise $7 trillion to build, you know, like, you know, like a civilization changing technology. That is an option that is, you know, there is an existence proof that that is on the table. And that should change what you think it means to be ambitious. And I think often one of the most valuable things you can do for an entrepreneur is literally just having a conversation like this one. It's not that they're wrong that they're ambitious. It's that they're sort of like thinking in too small a context about what that means.
To look at the flip side of this conversation we've been having about kind of pro or important qualities for a founder to have, are there any immediate anti-signals that you've found in prospective founders that you would say, no, I don't see you succeeding here?
I think the kind of obvious one, and again, I'm sorry because you'll have heard it so many times before, but like the obvious one is failure to learn. It's you know, and there's so many different ways into this, but I think clearly it's true that stubbornness is extremely important in a founder. And when I say failure to learn, I don't mean that like people to, you know, like smart, wise people who should know tell you that you're wrong, and so you update and realize you're wrong. I mean, clearly that would not be a helpful trait in a founder. But like, as a founder, you should be, you know, one way of thinking about what you're doing is you're just running a sort of constant real-time experiment where everything you believe about the world, both what it is and what it should be, is being tested, and you're getting a stream of data that tells you has some signal in it. And if you can't update in response to that signal, you're really going to struggle, however smart you are, however determined you are, all these things. And, you know, I think one way, I can't remember, it's been so hard to remember which of the many sort of psychology studies of the last few decades have failed to replicate. And so I'm always hesitant to use any examples. I think growth mindset has turned out not to be very replicable. But one thing I like, just at the level of like an intuition pump about growth mindset, is the idea of, you know, nothing like woo about it, more just the like, do you process failure as like, as a learning opportunity or not? Like, do you see it as something that you, that means you are, you know, you are wrong and bad and, you know, like a failure? Or do you process it as like a signal that allows you to update in some way and change your plan? Now, again, like, I'm not making any claim about growth mindset, the idea, right, but I like that framing as like, just do you have what it takes to take often a lot of negative signal and actually it guide you in a better direction?
When you started EF, you had this intuition or this hypothesis that we could have another model within startups, within or adjacent to venture capital, where we invested in people directly. I am, as I said before we started the episode, fascinated by alternative models of investing in people. And so I'm wondering if now, with the benefit of hindsight, but also with kind of the landscape, the world changing somewhat over the course of 13 years, if there's any new approaches to investing in people or in companies that you would, if starting today, like to experiment with, or you're seeing other people experiment with that fascinate you, whether it's moving to a younger demographic, maybe it's funding them in different ways in terms of grants, maybe it's giving them longer runway, whatever it looks like. I'm just curious if there's novel models that you're fascinated by or think we should be experimenting with more.
Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, it's a space that I've tried to follow pretty closely, and I love that there is now this huge diversity of experiments that's gone on. I mean, I think we feel pretty lucky with where we landed up, and there's been various points along the way where we've seen something new and said, "Oh man, like that feels really smart," and maybe we, you know, like for structural reasons, it's hard for us to pivot that for whatever it to that, and then be quite glad that we couldn't. You know, like I was very intrigued by the big wave of innovation around income sharing agreements that I would think of as like a, maybe that's like a 2017-18 sort of, there was a lot of activity in that space. You know, I think the core challenge for any talent investing model, as it is probably in most ventures, is adverse selection. Like, you know, you just, if your goal is to make money, your challenge in any of these things is that you attract the people that need you, and the people that need you are not the ones that you want. And it seems like the income sharing agreement sort of space broadly suffered from that a lot. You know, I think we've been fortunate at EF that I think because we were so terrified of adverse selection from the beginning, you know, we've done a lot to try and figure out how we like protect ourselves against that at every stage, both like how we find people and how we build relationships with them and how we select and how we invest. But it's really hard. I mean, I think it plagues most models in the space. You know, I think the single biggest structural challenge that I see in what we do, and you know, we're fortunate that turns out that what we do has a lot of economic advantages that mean that, you know, it's not like a macro problem for us. But you know, if I had to like leave EF and start something in the space, but obviously wouldn't want to compete with EF, the space I would explore that EF is not good for is the sort of longer term bets. So you know, we focus largely on first time founders, either right at the beginning of their career. So we take a lot of people who are straight out of school, straight out of university, or people who are like, you know, like 5-ish years into a career. So I would call both those groups early career. And the thing that happens is that we fund them. We think they're great. We're really excited about them. Their companies fail. And then they start another company later, and it's great. And now we're lucky that actually, because of some of the things that we do and the relationships we build, we've actually been fortunate to fund a bunch of people more than once. And, you know, like often their second companies look really great. So, but I think I'm less talking about this case where someone fails and then, you know, they take a month off and then they start again. Like, I think EF is pretty good at covering that use case. I'm talking more about you spot someone when they're 18 years old and you think you can like provide them a community and a set of resources and a, you know, sort of like a hopefully just something valuable, but you know that it's like, you're not trying to capture, you know, like your value capture mechanism isn't the company they start when they're 18. It's something that extends a lot longer. That I think is a, you know, we're not good at capturing that. And, you know, I think it's probably for new talent investors, which is what we call the people that join us. I think this can be a frustration. You know, you feel like you've done the bit you're meant to do, which is spot potential, but then you have no way of actually making right. that work in our model. And, you know, I'm not sure whether there is a really good private sector for-profit way to capture value in that model, in ways that aren't exploitative or that don't suffer from adverse selection. You know, one of the things I've thought a little bit about in the past is like, this is sort of feels like something a government could do. You know, like you're kind of describing a fiscal system. You know, have a bunch of upfront, but like in reverse, like normally in a fiscal right. system, people, you know, the sort of cliche narrative is people pay in their whole life and then draw out at the end when they need it. Like, I think there's a case that, you know, a government can capture the benefit of funding a bunch of people to have a lot of freedom at a point where they otherwise wouldn't, and then they capture the benefit through those people doing something valuable. I think it's hard to do as an investor, and probably maybe even wrong to do as an investor. I look at things like outside the government. I mean, no government that I know of does this, but it's often like interesting to me, like if you have an income sharing agreement with some upfront payout, like it's a little bit like features of a state. I'm a big fan of what Tyler Cowen's done with Emergent Ventures. And, you know, I think, you know, when I talked to him about it, like one thing I'm really struck by is that the structure he has where he's not an investor is actually one of the reasons that it works. And, you know, I think, yeah, it's funny, you line up all these things like, you know, adverse selection is a big challenge of all talent models. Value capture is a big challenge of all these models. Scaling is a huge challenge of all these models. You know, you look at the Thiel Fellowship, I think you have to say that is like maybe the greatest, you know, sort of talent investing operation so far, or at least it was in its early days. And, you know, one, doesn't have any value capture mechanism other than, you know, Peter being, you know, sort of adjacent to it and being an investor, although, you know, he didn't do the Ethereum, you know, pre-ICO funding, and it hasn't scaled. You know, they've been very, very explicit that they've not tried to scale. So, you know, I think there's just a lot of challenges that make doing something in this space scale, and you just have to make trade-offs. I like the trade-offs we've made. In many ways, they're a product of Alice and my aesthetic preferences and what we're trying to do. But you know, there's so much idea space that's yet to be explored, I would say.
You've dovetailed nicely into the next question I wanted to ask you. I've had several conversations with Danielle Strachman, who is one of the kind of co-founders of the Thiel Fellowship. Yeah. And I've posed this question to her and several other people in kind of this, we'll call it generally granting space. But why is it that we don't have more multi-million or billionaire kind of patrons doing something like the Thiel Fellowship to fund these other, either fund in a way that venture capital can't or fund projects that venture capital can't because it doesn't have the same like financial asymmetry in terms of the outcomes. Why don't we have like 100 Thiel Fellowships, or do we? And I'm just not.
Think we do. I suspect that it's something to do with the nature of taste for talent. So, you know, one thing that's really hard, one of the reasons it's really hard to scale any of these things, is that usually successful versions of these kinds of models are about a founding grantor investor who just has unusually good taste for whatever reason. Sometimes they're lucky, sometimes they're good, you know, maybe I was more lucky than good, but you know, like all of these programs, the thing that matters, even programs are the wrong word, like all of these like efforts start around a very small number of individuals, usually one or two individuals' taste in people. And it's not obvious that you can scale that. And it's not obvious you can outsource that. I mean, another thing that Tyler says is that, you know, like principal agent problems are the core problem in every talent operation. Like it's really hard to outsource it. So I think part of the reason billionaires in general don't want to do this is that a lot of what it would require to make it work is them to have good taste in people, which they, you know, like they're more likely than average to do so. But it's very time intensive. You know, like as I've, you know, I've recently gone back to spending a lot more of my time directly doing what we call talent investing, and I'm loving it, but I forgot it's like super time intensive, super time intensive. And so, you know, if you're a billionaire with, you know, an opportunity cost, yeah, on your capital, but also on your time, you either need to dedicate a lot of time to this, which is not something that billionaires typically have, or you need to find someone who you just think has unusually great taste, and be willing to back them. And again, like I don't want to, I think the Thiel Fellowship is totally extraordinary. I mean, like there's no arguing with the track record, but, you know, I think it's also been through phases, and, you know, Danielle and, you know, her co-founders, I think, just did have incredible taste. I don't actually know enough about, you know, where the fellowship's operating today, but, you know, the risk with a, so this is not about them, this is like a general observation that as you try and scale something, or as the, you know, you try and move beyond the original sort of like taste makers, the risk is that you end up focusing on talent with more and more legible characteristics of excellence, you know, so which is fine, to be clear, like that's a socially valuable thing, but it's much less likely to identify and fund outliers. You know, like if I had to outsource my job to a bunch of smart, very smart people, very effective people who'd never done it before, I imagine, and I wasn't allowed to like provide any apprenticeship, I just had to try and like somehow communicate my objective function, I imagine they would converge pretty quickly on heuristics that sounded about right. Where did this person go to university? What did they study? Like, what prizes did they win? Where did they work? And it would do like a lot of the work. But it would, I think, and maybe I'm flattering myself, I think it would lose a lot of like what makes outliers actually, right. You know, kind of like it makes you select outliers. And, you know, I have noticed that, you know, like you, and, you know, it'd be interesting, maybe we should talk about this. Like one of the core challenges for EF, and I think something that we've cracked after a lot of thought, is like, cool, well, you know, part of the pitch of EF to investors is that actually we found a way to scale taste, and, you know, like, how do you do that? And I think the unfortunate answer is very slow. You know, like what I don't think you can do is like create an algorithm, or, you know, like build a, you know, a simple LinkedIn scraper or whatever, and suddenly you're a talent investor. I think it's all about apprenticeship. And, you know, what we've shifted to over the last year. So this is a very long answer to your question about like why on the
this is great. Doing this.
But like,
I you could know, talk like, about this for hours.
What we've shifted to is saying, actually, we're not going to try in general to hire senior people to be talent investors. We're going to hire junior people and just invest a lot of time in apprenticeship. And we really believe this works. Like when we look at the people who were not there on day one, I mean, literally only Alice and I were there on day one. Look at the people who are not there on day one, but whose track record at EF is really great. It's about apprenticeship. And often those people, I think, end up having much better taste than I do, or, you know, minimum like just spikes in particular areas where they consistently find people I would never find. And although I don't think that they can, what I think none of us have been able to do is like extract that into like a format that you can hand over as a textbook. I do think that I observed that the people, the junior talent investors on my team that I'm most excited about today, are the ones that just seem to have spent most time hanging around with other people with really good taste. And I think it's a great model. I'm very biased in saying so. You can imagine if you're a billionaire looking for a high impact way to spend a lot of money, it's kind of fraught with fragility unless you have like someone willing to build a whole system. And, you know, I guess that's what we have done at EF. And I guess in some ways we are funded by billionaires. So maybe there's more of that happening than maybe it appears.
Yeah. And maybe it comes down to a matter of framing. It's not Peter Thiel slapping his name on a thing and being the sole backer and his reputation being tied to that thing. But instead you become a little more behind the scenes LP, but you can achieve some of the same ends. And if there's any, you know, multimillionaires or billionaires that you know or that are listening that want to try their hand at outsourcing their taste to me, I would love to try a program like this.
I actually think that's kind of an interesting idea. I mean, like, you know, if a billionaire came to me tomorrow and said, you know, I'd like to put $100 million into the space, but none of it can go to EF. You know, it'd be kind of interesting to build an EF for talent investors across different fields, as in, you know, like trying to back people who want to be talent spotters, talent nurturers, and amplifiers outside what we do. I think there are actually probably teachable lessons for that. And obviously I'm super biased, but I think it is a thing that across different aspects of the, different elements of the economy, having even just a small number of people whose lives are dedicated to identifying exceptional talent and amplifying it feels like a socially valuable thing to do.
Absolutely. You pick the right ones and there's billions of dollars and thousands of jobs, tens of thousands of jobs created. It's and if you feel like you've cracked the code on identifying talent and can transmit some amount of that to the next person, obviously there's no substitute for experience, I think, but over time with enough exposure.
That would be fascinating. And you know, like, again, sort of being a little bit more navel-gazing and looking what we're trying to do at TF, I think, you know, one of my hypotheses is that, you know, 10 years from now, it strikes me that there should be at least as many talent investors as there are venture investors. I don't mean like, you know, obviously I'd like them to be at EF, but you know, I mean that in more of a zoomed out perspective. Like it feels weird to me that, you know, like there's so much evidence, both anecdotal and academic, that as a species we misallocate talent. You know, you've probably come across you know, this famous study looking at you know, people who win gold medals in international mathematical olympiads and sort of what happens to them. And you know, the sort of depressing thing is like where they live turns out to be the most significant variable, not like the underlying talent. And, you know, okay, that's like one tiny slice of a tiny, you know, like a particular kind of talent, but kind of strongly suggests to me that we're not doing a very good job, even at the basic level of macro talent allocation. You know, there's a bunch of, you know, papers that draw similar conclusions. And so it strikes me that just having at least as many people running around the world trying to find exceptional talent and direct them to a, you know, a more valuable set of opportunities, it should be at least as valuable as the number of people running around the world, often actually in a somewhat zero-sum game of who gets allocation in a hot deal. Mm-hmm. Not to be disparaging to venture capitalists, some of my best friends are venture capitalists, but you know, like it does strike me that 20 years from now, I hope we'll look back and say, wow, it's kind of crazy that we had so few talent investors.
Why? What's your best guess about why that is? And I 100% agree. I've for a while now thought that the ability to identify talent in some contexts, venture capital being one of those, or identifying founders and startups more broadly, the ability to identify talent is actually more important than being talented itself. Because you can scale your, if you give me $100 billion and I have the ability to allocate that over, you know, tens or hundreds of founders, now I've significantly amplified my impact. So why is it that you don't think we have more talent scout programs or an emphasis on that?
I think it's probably a business model question. You know, there's lots of things I'm really proud of about what we've built at EF, but I think the most important thing is the business model innovation. You know, we had to invent a kind of funding instrument that allowed you to lay out, you know, roughly a third of what EF spends every year we give as this sort of stipend before a company exists. And like, how do you create a value capture moment about around that justifies the outlay? You know, I hope that, you know, 20 years from now, when there are lots of talent investors in the world relative today and someone writes the history of it, maybe they'll say that you know, that business model innovation was an important moment because it took something from being socially valuable, but with little incentive to do, into something with, you know, a lot of incentive to do. And, you know, I already said, you know, my critique of like, why is there no like longer term, you know, talent investing that says like over a career, I want to bet on this person, is a business model failure. Like there's just no value capture mechanism. And I think the same was true even of the thing that we do. And, you know, I think it's taken probably because I'm truly terrible at marketing. And, you know, I think Alice would say it's not her DNA either. You know, I think even though actually EF has made a lot of our early investors a lot of money, and it, like I think the evidence that the model works is pretty clear at this stage, I think it's still not widely appreciated that that's true. And, you know, I hope, you know, like it's quite nice to be able to do this without too much competition, but, you know, I kind of hope that from a social value perspective that as it becomes more and more obvious that this works, that we'll have more, that we'll have more people try and do things like it.
Yeah. I think maybe as competitive advantages in the current model melt away, then you have to either move upstream or develop better competitive advantages in the existing game you're playing.
Yeah, and you know, I think there'll be flavors of it. You know, I mean, I think EF is a generalist, and hopefully, you know, both the brand and the track record and things mean that, you know, there's a sustainable advantage there. Obviously, I would say that, but you know, I also think there will be other ways that I think people will create other value capture mechanisms. People will apply this to other fields that are not building technology companies. You know, I mean, clearly, I don't want to take, obviously it's like ludicrous to take too much credit for this. I mean, clearly there are models that have figured out, I mean, like the venture capital scout model is a version of this. It's just that it's less systematic version, I would guess. And, you know, and often seen as a stepping stone to becoming a VC, whereas, you know, my aspiration is that being a talent investor is the final goal.
Yeah. You announced recently that you are assuming a new role within EF focused on AI, and you're handing over the reins to Alice. This is potentially a big question, but maybe you can hit the more important points of why now, why make that shift now, and why the focus. I think the second part of this question is a bit more obvious, but why the focus on AI?
Yeah, I mean, I think the why now is really driven by, for me, the two questions are connected. So, mm-hmm. You know, we've been very lucky at Entrepreneur First to be investing in AI companies for a decade now. And, you know, we're lucky to be investing in talent that was interested in, you know, machine learning, literally as the sort of first wave of the deep learning revolution sort of hit in 2012-13, and as a result it's been the area where I've invested most time both intellectually and professionally. And it was very exciting to, you know, kind of just see the extraordinary transformation of that field over the last, you know, kind of six seven years. And you know, through that and through, you know, having invested in some of the at least prominent UK companies in that space, you know, getting pulled into a number of policy conversations. And, you know, my view of AI is that it's like, it's both the biggest opportunity that we have and also one of the biggest challenges that we face. And so, you know, one thing, which I guess is quite unusual, that I ended up doing last year was that I took a leave of absence from EF for 3 months to go serve in government on a temporary basis. The Prime Minister asked me to co-lead the AI safety summit that the UK hosted in Bletchley Park in November. It was a very weird experience as a complete government outsider to be a parachuted in as a quite senior diplomat overnight. And, you know, it was a really extraordinary experience and one that I loved. It both like made me realize that the time is now, that, you know, this is a technology that is sort of rapidly gonna, I guess it's kind of weird because like I'm guessing most people listening to this are like somewhat like plugged into like tech, and so, you know, for them it's like, well, kind of obvious, but you know, one of the striking things to me was speaking to policymakers around the world, and I was lucky to fly all over the world to do this, including to, you know, Beijing and other places, and just realizing that we haven't seen anything yet Like most of the world is only just waking up to this technology. And, you know, I came out of that experience really feeling like at least the next couple of years are going to be a window of time where some generationally important companies get built in this space. And feeling very energized by the role that talent investing could play in that. But also realizing that EF is now it's a medium-sized company. You know, it has 100 talent investors, several thousand alumni, a portfolio of like, I can't remember, 500-600 startups. We're regulated in like 5 or 6 jurisdictions around the world. We have like hundreds of millions of dollars of other people's money, which we, you know, look after for them and invest for them. And, you know, when you add all these things up, being the CEO of EF is like, it's close to a full-time job in the sense of like, without even seeing a founder, before you even get right into the act of talent investing. And so, you know, I'm very lucky. The co-founder relationship I've had with Alice for a long time, you know, I think we're very aligned on what we're trying to build. And, you know, I just came back to her and said, I think talent investing is more important than it's ever been. I think it's going to be higher impact than it's ever been. And I want to do more of it. And so, you know, how do you feel about swapping? And I say swapping, I mean, Alice was also doing a full-time exec role at EF, running our sort of product function. And, you know, I'm really lucky that Alice was excited to take on the CEO role. And, you know, I'll be honest, like it's the time we're recording this, we're sort of like 2.5 months into this transition, and she's doing an amazing job. I have not freed up quite as much time yet from executive responsibilities as I would like, but I'm on the right path to that. And it just came together at a really good time. And, you know, now that I have carved out maybe half my week, which I hope we'll get to, well, like 80% of my week to just sit down with people that are thinking about building the space, you just realize that anyone who thinks this has played out, you know, like we already know who the winners are and, you know, we're done. And that's ludicrous. Not that I think that today's companies are not going to be really important. You know, I think it's very clear that, you know, that there are companies out there that are, you know, a few years into the space that are already iconic companies. But it's more just like this space is going to touch everything. So the opportunity set is just so huge.
Still so nascent. You touched on this a bit, but you're one of the few people, at least that I'm aware of, that is at the intersection of or has gotten exposure to both the private and public side of AI as an innovation. You are obviously running EF, and then you just touched on how you were active in policy and helping shape policy and conversations around it. I'll put this very bluntly, is AI safety kind of futile as an endeavor, given that the comparative speed of bureaucracy and tech, the private and public interests on the private side, obviously financial, on public, there's geopolitical considerations like the US versus China. And that at the end of the day, we won't know what AI will lead to in the same way that we didn't know what the internet led to. So bundling this all up, how should we be thinking about AI safety or regulation?
Yeah, I mean, well, so you sort of you got to my answer right in the last bit. You know, I think there are certain visions of AI safety that are non-starters. Like, if you think there's going to be a single world government that like is able to monopolize the production of AI, you know, I don't think there is a viable future for that. And frankly, I'm not sure there's even a desirable future. I'll be strong in that. That is not a desirable future. I think one of the challenges of this space is that the number of, again, like, I want to be clear, like the opportunity is enormous. And, you know, I say, you know, I always tell people, like, the greatest thing that happened in the history of our species was the Industrial Revolution. And it had a lot of negative consequences, but I don't see how you can look at it and on net say, thank God that happened. AI has the opportunity to be, you know, like at least the same order of positivity for humanity. But it also takes some of those negatives that we experienced from the Industrial Revolution and you know, potentially amplifies them in ways that are, you know, like genuinely worrying and dangerous. And again, like it, I've never been an advocate of like a pause. I didn't think that was either desirable or possible. But I think one of the reasons I'm emphasizing this is that if you look at what I would call the threat models, if you look at like the ways in which we might legitimately worry about unsafe AI, they're not only diverse, but they're in tension with one another. You know, like there are some really serious, credible people that know a lot about both AI and call it like traditional like bio risk that think not GPT-4, but you know, like it's completely conceivable that GPT-5 or 6 or 7 or whatever could give like really destructive powers to anyone that's able to access a sort of unfiltered version of it. So if you think that's the dominant threat model, that makes you worried about open source. That makes you say like, well, you know, this is like irreversible proliferation of extraordinary power. And then that makes you like people that think that start to think about like, what are the both technical and legislative and other mechanisms you have to restrict open source? On the other hand, I totally empathize with the idea that like one of the biggest risks that AI brings is massive concentration of power.
Right.
Like, in the most positive scenarios, positive for the technology, I mean, you know, this is a technology that just allows you to accumulate influence measured on multiple dimensions, financial, social, political, in ways that like no other technology. Well, it feels like the best antidote to that is open source. Like, the, you know, right. It feels like we should want. And again, it's like
a bit of a paradox.
I just think anyone who has I'm really suspicious. Not suspicious of them, but I'm very skeptical of any point of view that is too wedded to a particular threat model and therefore a particular answer. And so, you know, I mean, I'm a bit biased because I did play a reasonably big role in its creation, but I do think the UK AI Safety Institute is an interesting model in that it's not a regulator, it's not a legislator, it's a government-funded, government-backed, well, it's part of government, but it is a research organization that is trying to put some of these questions on an empirical footing. You know, I do not believe in the model of regulation where a bunch of politicians sit in a room trying to imagine everything that could go wrong and then say it's not allowed to happen. and, you know, I'm not going to point at any jurisdiction, but there are some jurisdictions that make legislation like that. I think we need to put this on an empirical footing. And, you know, one thing that I think, although I think it's recognized somewhat, I think one thing that OpenAI deserve credit for is the idea of, you know, sort of incremental safety through iterative deployment. The idea that actually by, and you know, this was a controversial idea not that long ago, but the idea that actually by putting out into the world things that have recently become possible, you get to like actually refine your view of like what the threat models are. And that allows you to, you know, incrementally make things safer by responding to that. And we need that. Like this should be, I do not think it's been helpful or productive for AI safety to be primarily a field where people exchange thought experiments. It really is much better, I think, for it to be one where we have evidence, we have data, we have experiments, we try and apply as far as we can something that looks at least a little bit like the scientific method, and we update as we learn. And I understand the counter argument. I understand that there are some scenarios in which that's insufficient. But I think like scenario, I just think people generally need to embrace the fact that there's radical uncertainty here and we will not know. We will not know in advance everything that might go wrong.
Well, I know I posed that question to you just as we were coming to a close, but I appreciate the considered and in some ways bipartisan or even nonpartisan approach to the answer. The final question I have for you only takes about 20 seconds. I ask all my guests to flip it around on you. What's one question you'd leave me and listeners with whether to think about or act on?
Well, I think given where we spent a lot of this conversation, the one that comes to mind is to the extent that you care about this space of talent identification and amplification, what are you doing to, what is your equivalent of getting the reps in to improve your taste? It's actually, I think, a learnable skill. And, you know, like, this is not an advert, but, you know, I think, like, for people listening who are like, actually, I do buy that this is an important thing and maybe, like, an important career, you know, what we're building at EF is a place for people to come and not only build companies, but come work for us and, like, build their craft in being a, you know, a talent spotter, a talent nurturer. And I always like when I interview prospective talent investors, say like, what do you do that is your equivalent of getting the reps in for nurturing your taste? And I think anyone interested in the future of talent, the future of education, the future of technology, I think that's actually an important question, because I think we're moving into a world that's going to be more and more dominated by outlier outcomes from outlier individuals. You might think that's not a good thing, but I think it's going to happen. And so agreed. I think your ability to identify and support and nudge those individuals in a positive direction could be a really important lever for building the world you want to see.
Excellent call to action and full circle moment. Matt, thank you so much for your time. This was incredible.
Thank you. It's been great fun.